Penrose lay back, his large body relaxed in its leather sling. I could see that he was keen to be frank with me, and confident that he could convert me to his cause. For the first time, a strain of idealism lit his unwavering eyes, a commitment to his patience that went far beyond professional concern. Watching his little smirks and ingratiating grimaces, I knew that nothing would be gained by challenging him. The more freely he spoke, the more he would incriminate himself. He smiled at the sun, talking in an almost rueful tone. "When I came here, Paul, I thought Eden Olympia was the ante-room to paradise. A beautiful garden city, everything town planners had been working towards for centuries. All the old urban nightmares had been dispelled at a stroke. Street crime, traffic congestion, minor irritations. The real problems had simply been left out of the blueprint. And that's a little worrying. Whether we like it or not, Eden Olympia is the face of the future. Already there are hundreds of business and science parks around the world. Most of us, or at least most professional people, are going to spend our entire working lives in them. But they all suffer from the same defect. Too much leisure? No. Too much work." Penrose flexed his arms, and then allowed them to settle themselves. "Work dominates life in Eden Olympia, and drives out everything else. The dream of a leisure society was the great 20th century delusion. Work is the new leisure. Talented and ambitious people work harder than they have ever done, and for longer hours. They find their only fulfillment through work. The men and women running successful companies need to focus their energies on the task in front of them, and for every minute of the day. The last thing they want is recreation. The active mind never needs to rest. That's hard to accept. It needn't be. Creative work is its own recreation. If you're drafting a patent on a new gene, or designing a cathedral in Sao Paulo, why waste time hitting a rubber ball over a net? Your children can do that for you, assuming you have any children. Alas, today's corporate city is superbly talented, adult, and virtually childless. Look around you at Eden Olympia. No leisure activities, no community life or social gatherings. How many parties have you been invited to in the last 4 months? Hard to remember. Very few. Practically none, if you think back. People at Eden Olympia have no time for getting drunk together, for infidelities or rows with the girlfriend. No time for adulterous affairs or coveting their neighbor's wives. No time even for friends. There are no energies to spare for anger, jealousy, racial prejudice, and the more mature reflections that follow. There are none of the social tensions that force us to recognize other people's strengths and weaknesses, our obligations to them, or feelings of dependence. At Eden Olympia, there's no interplay of any kind. None of the emotional trade-offs that give us our sense of who we are. But you like it here. I tried to speak jokingly. After all, it is the new paradise. Does it matter? I hope it does. Accepting my raillery, Penrose bared his teeth. The social order must hold, especially where elites are involved. Eden Olympia's great defect is that there's no need for personal morality. Thousands of people live and work here without making a single decision about right and wrong. The moral order is engineered into their lives, along with the speed limits and the security systems. You sound like Pascal Zander. That's a police chief's lament. Paul. Penrose raised his hands towards the ceiling, trying to diffuse his impatience with me. I take the point. A sense of morality can be a convenient escape route. If the worst comes to the worst, we tell ourselves how guilty we feel, and that excuses everything. The more civilized we are, the fewer moral choices we have to make.
Exactly.
The airline pilot doesn't wrestle with his conscience over the right landing speed. He follows the manufacturer's instructions. But part of the mind atrophies. A moral calculus that took thousands of years to develop starts to wither from neglect. Once you dispense with morality, the important decisions become a matter of aesthetics. You've entered an adolescent world where you define yourself by the kind of trainers you wear. Societies that dispense with the challenged conscience are more vulnerable than they realize. They have no defense against the psychotic who gets into the system and starts working away like a virus, using the sluggish moral machinery against itself. You're thinking of David Greenwood. He's a good example. Penrose sat up and rubbed at a coffee stain on his white shirt, irritated by the dark smudge. The security people here won't admit it. But on May the 28th, they took at least an hour to react coherently, even when they actually heard gunshots. They couldn't believe that a madman with a rifle was walking into offices and shooting people dead. Their moral perception of evil was so eroded that it failed to warn them of danger. Places like Eden Olympia are fertile ground for any messiah with a grudge. The Adolf Hitlers and Pol Potts of the future won't walk out of the desert. They'll emerge from shopping malls and corporate business parks. Aren't they the same thing? Eden Olympia as an air-conditioned Sinai? Absolutely. Penrose pointed approvingly at me, the alert student in the front row of the lecture hall. We're on the same side, Paul. I want people to come together, not divide themselves into separate enclaves. The ultimate gated community is a human being with a closed mind. We're breeding a new race of deracinated people, internal exiles without human ties, but with enormous power. It's this new class that runs our planet. To be successful enough to work at Eden Olympia calls for rare qualities of self-restraint and intelligence. These are people who won't admit to any weakness and won't allow themselves to fail. When they arrive, their health is at a peak. They rarely touch drugs, and the glass of wine they have with dinner is a social fossil, like the christening mug and the family silver. But things go wrong. Nothing too obvious at first, but by the end of the first year, their energy levels begin to fall. Even a 12-hour day, 6 days a week, isn't long enough to get everything done. At the clinic, we've watched it happen dozens of times. People complain about the recirculated air and pathogens breeding in the filter fans. Of course, none of the air at Eden Olympia is recirculated. And the filters? They screen something out? Bird droppings and toilet wastes from aircraft using Nice Airport? Then people worry about security inside their office buildings. That's always a key indicator of internal stress, the obsession with the invisible intruder in the fortress. The other self, the silent brother who clones himself off from the unconscious. The neural networks are starting to uncouple themselves. Committee meetings are rescheduled for Sundays. Holidays abandoned after 24 hours. Finally, they make their way to the clinic. Insomnia, fungal infections, respiratory complaints, inexplicable migraines and attacks of hives. Old-fashioned burnout? That's what we thought with the first cases. Presidents of multinational companies and their CEOs. These people weren't anywhere near burnout. Penrose sounded almost disappointed as his eyes strayed across the white walls, searching for a blemish. But the creative edge was blunted, and they knew it. We urged them to take up skiing or yachting, book a suite at the Martinez and spend the weekend with a crate of champagne and a pretty woman. The perfect prescription, I commented. Did it work? No. There was no response at all. But the health checks threw up a curious fact. There was a very low level of venereal complaints, surprising when you think of these attractive men and women at the height of their powers, and all the business trips around the world. They weren't having much sex. Worse, they weren't having sex at all. We set up a bogus Lonely Hearts Club, hinting that there were any number of bored secretaries eager for a fling. No takers. The Adult Film Channel, hours of explicit hardcore, did no better. People watched, but in a nostalgic way, as if they were seeing a documentary about Morris dancing or roof thatching, an old craft skill popular with a previous generation. We were desperate. We held corporate parties with a chorus line of kiss-me-quick beauties, but all they did was look at their watches and keep an eye on their briefcases in reception. They'd forgotten they were living in paradise. This was an Eden without a snake. Short of making sexual intercourse a corporate requirement, there was nothing we could do. Meanwhile, immune levels across 100 boardrooms continued to fall. Faced with all this insomnia and depression, I went back to old-fashioned depth psychology. The leather couch and the lowered blinds. More the armchair in the sun-filled room. Psychiatry has moved on. Penrose stared at me, aware that I was waiting for him to trip himself. For all his jovial asides, his manner was relentlessly aggressive. As he flexed his legs and openly displayed his heavy thigh muscles, it occurred to me that psychiatry might be the last refuge of the bully. "Of course, Wilder," I apologized. "I'm behind the times. Jane showed me round Freud's house in Hampstead, dark and very strange. All those figurines and ancient idols. The antechamber to a pharaoh's tomb. The great man was preparing for death and surrounded himself with a retinue of lesser gods paying tribute to him." Forgiving me with a raised hand, Penrose went on, "Classical psychoanalysis starts with the dream, and that was my first breakthrough. I realized that these highly disciplined professionals had very strange dreams, fantasies filled with suppressed yearnings for violence, and ugly narratives of anger and revenge, like the starvation dreams of death camp prisoners. Despair was screaming through the bars of the corporate cage, the hunger of men and women, exiled from their deeper selves. They wanted more violence in their lives, more violence and cruelty, more drama and rage." Penrose clenched his huge fists and drummed them on the table, sending the coffee cups into a frenzy. "But how to satisfy them? Today we shun the psychopathic, the dark side of the sun and those shadows that burn the ground. Sadism, cruelty, and the dream of pain belong to our primate ancestors. When they surface in a damaged adolescent with a taste for strangling cats, we lock him away for good. The run-down chief executives, with their hives and depression, were sane and civilized men. Maroon them on a desert island after a plane crash, and they'd be the first to perish. Any perverse elements in their lives would have to be applied externally, like a vitamin shot or an antibiotic, or a small dose of madness. Let's say a carefully metered measure of psychopathy. Nothing too criminal or deranged, more like an adventure training course or a game of touch rugby. Shins will be barked, eyes blacked, but no bones broken." Penrose nodded approvingly. "I wish you'd been with me, Paul. You obviously have a feel for this sort of thing. Still, I needed to test the theory and start rolling this very odd-shaped ball. I could hardly sit at my desk in the clinic and tell some depressed CEO that he'd cure his insomnia by vandalizing a few mercs in the Palais des Festivals car park. Then, a senior manager with Hoechst showed me the way. He'd been out of sorts for months, and suffered from attacks of dermatitis. He even thought of transferring back to the head office in Dusseldorf. And what saved him? I think I can guess. Good. He saw a woman tourist in Cannes being mugged by an Arab youth, and went to her rescue. While she called the police, he gave the fellow a good beating, kicked him so hard that he broke two bones in his right foot. He came in a week later to have the cast removed, and I asked him about the dermatitis. It had gone. He felt buoyant and confident again, not a trace of depression. He knew why? Absolutely. Whenever he felt the blues coming on, he would take one of the security men into La Boca and provoke an incident with a passing immigrant. It worked a treat. He co-opted a couple of close colleagues, and they too cheered up. I asked if I could keep a professional eye on the exercise. Soon we had an active therapy group, with a dozen senior executives. At weekends, they'd start brawls in Maghrebian bars, trash any Arab cars that looked unroadworthy, rough up a Russian pimp or two. The health benefits were remarkable. Bandaged fists and plastered shins on Monday mornings, but clear, confident heads. Tough on the Arabs, though. True. But on the whole, the immigrant community benefits. Eden Olympia is a scrupulous equal opportunities employer, with no racial bias. We hire a disproportionate number of North Africans as gardeners and road sweepers. The immigrant population gains from the clearer heads of the people who do the hiring. A tricky balance to weigh. I assume the therapeutic system began to expand. I was surprised by how quickly. Vigilante actions, incidents of deliberate road rage, thefts from immigrant markets, tangles with the Russian mafiosi. Other therapy groups spread out into the fringes of drug dealing and prostitution, burglaries and warehouse robberies. A picked group of security men were paid foot soldiers, earning generous bonuses we deducted from the arts and recreations budget. The benefits were astounding. Immune levels rose through the ceiling. Within 3 months there wasn't a trace of insomnia or depression, not a hint of respiratory infections. Corporate profits and equity values began to climb again. The treatment worked. No side effects? A few. Penrose watched me as he spoke, curious to see how I reacted, and clearly pleased that I had not leapt from my chair in outrage. He spoke matter-of-factly, like an architect setting out the pros and cons of an experimental sewage system. There's a risk element, but it's acceptable. Eden Olympia has a lot of clout with the local authorities. In many ways, we're carrying out tasks the police would do anyway, and we free them for other duties. The sex side can be troubling. A few prostitutes have needed remedial surgery. Your friend Alain Delage is a little too free with his fists. There's a remarkable need for punitive violence hidden away in the senior executive mind. And sex tends to release it? It's meant to, for sound biological reasons. Sex is such a quick route to the psychopathic, the shortest of shortcuts to the perverse. We aren't running an adventure playground, but a forcing house designed to expand the psychopathic possibilities of the executive imagination. It needs to be carefully monitored. Sadomasochism, excretory sex play, body piercing and wife pandering can easily veer off into something nasty. It's surprising how many prostitutes object to rape, even of the most stylized kind. Unimaginative of them. Who knows? Penrose shrugged generously at the world and its curious ways. A few times I've had to step in and redirect the therapy. On the whole, though, it's worked well. Almost every senior executive at Eden Olympia is now involved in the program, even if only at the margins. And David Greenwood was aware of all this, to a large extent. He and I discussed it with Professor Kalman. The department heads at the clinic are in the know. They could see the benefits, and on the whole, David approved. The drug rehab center in Montlieu was plagued by small-time gangsters trying to muscle in on the methadone supply. It was a big help to him when the therapy groups came down from Eden Olympia and drove them out. The more aggressive road attacks bothered him, but he knew that the violence against the local prostitutes was a special kind of rehabilitation, a form of shock treatment that would send them back to their factory jobs. Penrose turned from me, a hand raised to catch a ray of sunlight over his head. He glanced at the opaque mirror behind him, as if waiting for an audience's response. His exposition had been almost playful, testing me with his callous asides, but he was clearly proud of his dubious achievement and its insane logic, a therapeutic breakthrough that would never be awarded the gold medals of the leading medical societies. This lonely commitment to his radical vision gave him an almost bear-like dignity. "The murders on May 28th, I said. "Were they part of David's therapy program?" "Paul, that's the great mystery of Eden Olympia. In his deranged way, David was a minor prophet, guiding us into the future. Meaningless violence may be the true poetry of the new millennium. Perhaps only gratuitous madness can define who we are. At the cost of breaking the law, your senior executives at Eden Olympia are committing enough crimes to get themselves locked away for the rest of their lives. That's true, on a literal level. Remember that these criminal activities have helped them to rediscover themselves. An atrophied moral sensibility is alive again. Some of my patients even feel guilty. A revelation to them." I listened to a car alarm sounding in the avenue, and imagined the French police bursting in to arrest us. "Guilt? Isn't that a design error? It only needs one CEO to go to the authorities, and your therapy program will be over. Curing a few cases of insomnia will count for nothing. Not just a few. But I agree with you." Penrose stared over my head, weighing the objection in his mind. "So far, people have been intelligent enough to see the point. They grasp the value of beating up an out-of-work Arab, some labourer with a wife and four children, living in a tin shack at a bidonville. Paul." Pained by my crude questions, Penrose reached out a hand to settle me, like a minister with a restive congregation. "Sit back and think things through. The 20th century was an heroic enterprise, but it left us in the dark, feeling our way towards a locked door. Here at Eden Olympia, there's a chink of light, a thin and fierce glow. Our own psychopathy, whether we like it or not. The 20th century ended with its dreams in ruins. The notion of the community as a voluntary association of enlightened citizens has died forever. We realize how suffocatingly humane we've become, dedicated to moderation and the middle way. The suburbanization of the soul has overrun our planet like the plague. Sanity and reason are unworthy of us. No, but a vast illusion, built from mirrors that lie. Today we scarcely know our neighbours, shun most forms of civic involvement, and happily leave the running of society to a caste of political technicians. People find all the togetherness they need in the airport boarding lounge and the department store lift. They pay lip service to community values, but prefer to be alone. Isn't that odd for a social animal? Only in some ways. Homo sapiens is a reformed hunter-killer of depraved appetites, which once helped him to survive. He was partly rehabilitated in an open prison called the First Agricultural Societies, and now finds himself on parole in the polite suburbs of the city-state. The deviant impulses coded into his central nervous system have been switched off. He can no longer harm himself or anyone else. But nature sensibly endowed him with a taste for cruelty and an intense curiosity about pain and death. Without them, he's trapped in the afternoon shopping malls of a limitless mediocrity. We need to revive him. Give him back the killing eye and the dreams of death. Together, they helped him to dominate this planet. So, psychopathy is freedom. Psychopathy is fun. A natty slogan, Paul. But it does contain a certain fiery truth. Penrose beamed at me, openly pleased with my progress. We're creatures of the treadmill. Monotony and convention rule everything. In a totally sane society, madness is the only freedom. Our latent psychopathy is the last nature reserve, a place of refuge for the endangered mind. Of course, I'm talking about a carefully metered violence, micro doses of madness, like the minute traces of strychnine in a nerve tonic. In effect, a voluntary and elective psychopathy, as you can see in any boxing ring or ice hockey rink. You've served in the armed forces, Paul. You know that recruits are deliberately brutalized. The drill sergeant's boot and the punishment run give back to young men a taste for pain that generations of socialized behavior have bred out of them. The toy poodle becomes a wolf again, but only when it wants to. Remember your childhood? Like all of us, you stole from the local supermarket. It was deeply exciting and enlarged your moral sense of yourself. But you were sensible and kept it down to one or two afternoons a week. The same rules apply to society at large. I'm not advocating an insane free-for-all. A voluntary and sensible psychopathy is the only way we can impose a shared moral order. And if we do nothing, danger will rush up to us and put a knife to our throat. Look at the century that lies ahead. An upholstered desert, but a wasteland all the same. An absence of faith, except for a vague belief in an unknown deity, like the sponsor of a public service broadcast. Wherever there's a vacuum, the wrong kind of politics creep in. Fascism was a virtual psychopathology that served deep unconscious needs. Years of bourgeois conditioning had produced a Europe suffocating in work, commerce, and conformity. Its people needed to break out, to invent the hatreds that could liberate them, and they found an Austrian misfit only too happy to do the job. Here at Eden Olympia, we're setting out the blueprint for an infinitely more enlightened community. A controlled psychopathy is a way of re-socializing people and tribalizing them into mutually supportive groups, like divisions of the Waffen-SS. At the Cardan Foundation, there was real violence. People might have been killed. It was more choreographed than you think. Violence is spectacular and exciting, but sex has always been the main hunting ground of psychopathy. A perverse sexual act can liberate the visionary self in even the dullest soul. The consumer society hungers for the deviant and unexpected. What else can drive the bizarre shifts in the entertainment landscape that will keep us buying? Psychopathy is the only engine powerful enough to light our imaginations, to drive the arts, sciences, and industries of the world. Your passing infatuation with that child in the Rue Valentin might spark off some vital new development in aviation. Penrose stood up, kicked the first stole out of his way, and began to stroll around the room, almost dismissing me with a flourish. Scenting the sunlight, he opened a window and filled his lungs. He had been saving little Natasha to the last, warning me from any rush to judgment. After inspecting himself in the mirror, he turned to stare down at me. The warring elements in his face, the ready smile and steely eyes, gave me the sense that several personalities were jostling for space in his large skull. "Paul, you can tell me. Are you going to the police?" "Probably. I need to think about it. I've been completely frank. I've held back nothing." "The Cannes police wouldn't understand a word. If they did, they'd probably agree with you." Penrose chuckled over this. "Still, the Cardin Foundation robbery? Are you going to report it?" "Not for a day or two." "I'll tell you when I do." "Good. I need to know. There are large issues here, involving a great many powerful people. Don't worry. It would be easy to arrange a ratissage for an Englishman who's overstayed his welcome. An old Jaguar with fading brakes, the High Corniche Road, an empty bottle of cognac in the wreckage. At least I'd have cured some chief executive's migraine." "Paul..." Penrose seemed disappointed in me. "This isn't a regime of gangsters." "Gangsters and psychopaths? Surely that's the prospectus you've been setting out. What I still can't grasp is where David Greenwood fits into all this." I waited for Penrose to reply, but he stood with his back to the sun, arms limply at his sides, his large chest deflating. As I watched his uneasy grimaces, the heavy knuckles that cuffed his nose, I realized that he was hoping for my approval. He needed me to understand him, and the brave gamble he had taken for the sake of Eden Olympia. In some way he had failed David Greenwood, and he was now doing his best to avoid failing me. Then he noticed me standing by the coffee table, and rallied himself. Smiling affably, he strolled up to me and held my shoulders. He steered me towards the Alice mirror, as if we were about to step together into its glassy deeps. He swerved away at the last moment and pushed me to the door, laughing soundlessly to himself. "Paul, sit by the pool and give it some thought." Before propelling me into the avenue, he whispered fiercely, "Think, Paul. Think like a psychopath." Chapter 30. Nietzsche on the Beach. After leaving Penrose, I needed breakfast and the strongest coffee I could make. Dust lay over the swimming pool, an overnight veil disturbed by the feeble movements of a waterlogged fruit fly, struggling against the meniscus that gripped its wings in a mirror harder than glass. Sympathizing with the creature, whose predicament matched my own, I searched for the damp footprints that usually marked Jane's race back to the house, and a long bath, earphones over her soapy head as the Walkman played Debussy. But the tiled verge was dry in the late November sun. I walked to the terrace and stepped into the hall, where I bruised my shins against two of my leather suitcases. I gripped the handles and guessed from their weight that they held my entire wardrobe. Upstairs, drawers slammed as Jane roamed the cupboards. The punitive jolts of Carmina Burana sounded from the bedroom, a call to marital strife. Without thinking, I knew that Jane was throwing me out, and felt a deep regret that we would never drive the RN7 back to Paris together. Our marriage had ended, like those of my friends, in a mess of trivial infidelities and questions with no conceivable answers. I had reached the villa at midnight, after an evening and on tea with Francis Baring. From the clinic, Jane had earlier called me to say she would be late, and suggested that I see a film in Cannes. But as I tiptoed past the darkened lounge, the faint moonlight revealed that she had recruited other company to amuse her. The carpet was marked by almost lunar ridges, left by heel marks that belonged to neither Jane nor myself. Aware of Francis's scent on my hands, I moved to the children's room and slept soundly among Tenniel's amiable menagerie. I woke at 7 and telephoned Wilder Penrose from the bathroom, determined to confront him with the criminal reality of Eden Olympia. Jane was still asleep when I left to see Penrose. She lay face down, an infected puncture point on the inside of her thigh, oozing a faint lymph. I eased back the drawer of the dressing table and counted the used serrets, hoping that my arithmetic was at fault. Jane breathed quietly, an aging Alice, in an expurgated chapter of her own book. Careful not to wake her, I kissed her open lower lip, still marked by the paste of another woman's lipstick. I met her on the landing, dragging a suitcase from the bedroom. As always, she had recovered quickly from the dose of diamorphine. She wore jeans and white vest, a garb she'd abandoned soon after arriving at Eden Olympia. But her skin was pale and putty-coloured, and her face seemed toneless. She'd cut her left hand on one of the suitcase locks, but had yet to notice the blood. She saw me watching from the door, reached into a wardrobe and pulled out a heavy rucksack. "Paul, can you help me? Stick that on the bed." "Sure." "Tell me what's happening." "Nothing to worry about. You're leaving half an hour from now."
"I'm leaving."
"Why?"
"We're both leaving. We're saying goodbye to Eden. I've told personnel to post an angel with a flaming sword by the gate."
"Jane?" I stepped through the clutter of unpaired shoes that she was rooting from the cupboard, placed my hand under her arms, and lifted her to her feet, surprised by how much weight she had lost.
"Calm down."
"Now, when exactly are we leaving?"
"Now, today, as soon as I'm packed."
"And where are we going?" Jane shrugged, staring at the chaos of half-filled suitcases.
"England? London? Paris? Anywhere? Away from here?"
I reached out to the radio on the bedside table and switched off the French concert commentator.
"Why?"
"You have another 6-month contract to run."
"I'll take a week's compassionate leave." "We'll simply not come back."
"Professor Kalman won't like that. It could damage your career."
"Staying here will finish it. Believe me, the last thing they want is another English doctor going insane."
"Jane." I tried to take her shoulders, but she sidestepped me, marking the pattern of her bare feet in the talc like an evasive dance step.
"Are you all right?"
"Completely compos mentis." She stared at herself in the dressing table mirror, jaw thrust forward.
"No, I'm not all right, and nor are you. Where's the getaway car? I don't want to drive to Calais in the little Peugeot."
"The Jag's outside." "Tell me why you want to leave. Is it anything I've done?"
"Have you done anything? I'm amazed."
Jane rolled her eyes in mock alarm. She placed her hands on my chest.
"Dear husband, you're a decent and kindly man, more or less, and I want to keep you that way. I don't know where you stay out all night, and I won't ask. I hope she's sweet and appreciates you. But I'm sure of one thing. Remain here any longer, and you'll end up like the rest of us."
"Jane, why now?
Has something worried you?"
"The business of the Cardin Foundation."
"Cardin? Not my favourite schmutter. You mean the robbery at Miramar?"
"You've heard about it?"
"Simon and I saw it on the news. Alain was driving through Théoul as the gang sped off and tried to stop them. Poor man, he was covered with bruises. I had to patch him up."
She rubbed the infected needle mark on her thigh.
Alain said he saw you later at the Villa Grimaldi.
A stag night, laid on by Pascal Zander.
Ghastly man. I'm glad I wasn't there. He invents imaginary venereal symptoms so he can roll out his big cannon. It's quite a spectacle. He's perpetually tumescent in a nasty way.
A good reason for leaving.
So it isn't me that you want to get away from? I want to get away from myself. She sat on the bed, hands over her small breasts, as if feeling her tender nipples. There are too many mirrors in this house, and I don't like what I see in them. Outside the clinic, I hardly exist. I'm tired all the time, and I keep picking up small infections. For the last 2 months, I've had swollen tonsils. If you tried to kiss me, you'd never get your tongue in my mouth.
Have you talked to Penrose?
Walter Penrose? For a clever man, he has some odd ideas. He thinks we need to freshen up our sex life. How, he didn't quite say.
Something about prepubertal girls.
I told them that wasn't your scene. You liked them a good bit older. That's why you married me, isn't it?
You know it is.
Good.
She stared at my hands as I sat beside her, her eyes slightly out of focus. She raised my fingers to her lips and caught a strange scent clinging to the nails. Her eyes sharpened, and she glanced at me without comment.
Paul, you know I'm going to bed with Simone?
No, but I guessed.
I was so sleepy. It happened before I realized it. I thought we were playing girls in the dorm. But she had other ideas. You're not upset?
A little. We talked it through long ago.
Have you? Since school, once. Heterosexuality is hard work. Men make it into a big effort. When I get back from the clinic, I'm too tired for all those emotions. With Simone, I can switch off.
What about Alain?
He likes to watch. Sorry, Paul. You're too sane. If we stay here any longer, I'll go to bed with Alain. I don't want that to happen.
She sniffled into a corner of the sheet. Searching for a tissue, I pulled back the dressing table drawers and exposed the clutch of ampoules in her valise. Jane? All this pethidine.
How much can you take?
Then nothing.
Better for me than too many double scotches.
The diamorphine? It's pure heroin.
I'm all right.
She closed the drawer, and then stared at me curiously.
You never try to stop me. Not seriously? That's a little surprising.
You're the doctor.
You know how to handle the stuff.
No. Jane took my chin, forcing me to look her in the face.
You're keeping an eye on me, Paul. I'm your guinea pig. You want to know what happens to people in Eden Olympia?
That may be true.
I'm sorry. I hadn't realized it. It's part of your search for David Greenwood. You're totally obsessed with him. Why? Because we were lovers once. It was a long time ago.
Never long enough.
I felt myself sink slightly.
David was making a stand against Eden Olympia. It's the proving ground for a new kind of world. And he couldn't cope with that.
You've been listening to Wilder. Nietzsche on the beach. Philip Glass could set it to music.
He's serious.
But he's starting to give himself away. I need more time, Jane. That's why I'd like to stay on for a while. Let me explain it to you, and then you can decide if we leave. All right. She leaned against me, her breathing shallow, her putty skin giving off a stale odor that I had never noticed. As I listened to her slow heartbeat, I knew how deeply exhausted she was. I cleared a space among the suitcases, and laid her on the bed,
straightening the pillow under her head. I sat beside her, holding her hands between mine, and thought about her affair with Greenwood, and their quick sex, probably snatched at guys, in darkened laundry rooms. Jane was fond of me, but our marriage had been the last of her hippie gestures, the belief that impulsive acts alone give meaning to life. Sex and drugs had to be casually dispensed as a way of diffusing the myths around them.
"Paul, I'm going to sleep for a little."
Jane smiled at me as I stroked her damp forehead. Together we listened to an approaching publicity plane that climbed the valley from the coast, bringing to the business park its tidings of another marina complex or discount furniture sale. A few hundred yards from us, Wilder Penrose would be standing at his kitchen window, watching the wavering pennant as he laid his own, very different plans for the new Riviera.
This ends side two of cassette 7 of Super Can. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 8.